Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets to the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another episode of Soundbites. We're about to have a conversation with John Robbins. John Robbins, of course, has written books that have taken hold in our country, in our world, kind of challenging the way we think about our lives when we eat, Diet for a New America, of course, and the food revolution. He has a new book, and this is called No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Frontiers of the Food Revolution, and are a series of his columns that he's also tweaked for this book as well and updated. And John Robbins, pleasure to meet you and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here with you.
So let me take a step backwards. I like to assume that everybody knows everything or has read every book we talk about. So you've been doing this for a while. I mean, your first book that people grabbed hold of came back in 1991. But I'd like to just do a little backstory for a minute. Just you mentioned a little bit in the book that you are John Robbins and you are Robbins of Baskin and Robbins. And if you wouldn't mind, just for a moment, taking us to that story, to your what happened to you and why you said no to the money and the empire.
Well, my dad, Irv Robbins, and my uncle, Bert Baskin, were the founders and co-owners of 31 Flavors, which became the world's largest ice cream company. And my father basically groomed me to succeed him. I'm an only son, and it was his expectation that I would follow in his footsteps. And actually, I was moving along that path, but then several things happened. One was that my uncle, Bert Baskin, died of a heart attack at the age of 54. Mm. And when that occurred, I asked my dad, do you think there could be a connection between the amount of ice cream he would eat and his fatal heart attack? And my father just looked at me and said, absolutely not. His ticker just got tired and stopped working. And I saw that my father could not even consider that possibility. And I could understand why, because by that time he had manufactured and sold more ice cream than anyone who had ever lived on this planet. He didn't want to think the family's product was harming it, but he couldn't consider it, but I thought maybe I should. And I think there is a link. I'm not saying an ice cream cone is going to hurt anybody, but the more you eat, the more likely you are to have like killed my uncle. And I'm not pointing the finger, please understand, at Baskin-Robbins per se. Think of Ben Cohen, the co-founder and for many years co-owner of Ben & Jerry's. A wonderful man, by the way, Ben Cohen. He had a quintuple bypass in his late 40s. The more ice cream you eat, the more likely you are to have diabetes, which my father developed, to become obese like so many Americans today are. And I didn't feel like I wanted to make my money or derive my sustenance from selling a product that might be undermining anyone's health.
I mean, it takes a lot for a person to kind of walk away from that, especially in some senses. I mean, you've built a life, and you've built a life fighting for a better planet and fighting for people's lives, fighting for a new way of eating and growing our food. But, I mean, to walk away from a world which really was a world of privilege into kind of the unknown in some ways, is a pretty bold step to take.
Well, it most definitely was a world of privilege. And to be ethically consistent, when I told my father I was not going to work with him at the company, I said I didn't want to have any access to his fortune. I didn't want to depend on his achievements, his money. I wanted to live by my own values and seek my own way. It was a choice, really, for integrity. And it enabled me to have an objectivity about ice cream and the business and the great American food machine and what's really wrong with and there is a great deal wrong with our food system, that I wouldn't have had if I had been tethered to it, if I had been dependent on money made from it. So I walked away from a lot of financial security, it is true.
Mm-hmm.
But frankly and honestly, I felt more emotionally secure by doing that because I had my integrity.
You mentioned something, as you described the conversation with your father, that really seems, especially in this particular book, in your essays, you describe your meetings with everything from this incredible man who raised pigs to your friend who was obese to the guy paying for his groceries at the health food store. As an approach, which is an approach that seems almost like approach, if I could put it in a certain way, if this was like a political movement, it would be like a Gandhian nonviolent approach. Sort of the way you approach things is without kind of blame and kind of pushing people a certain way. It's how respecting where people come from and coming from it in that sense.
Well, I try to live with respect for myself and other people. Most people want to be respected, and we're adults here. We make our own food choices and have a right to do so. I don't blame people or ascribe guilt. But what I want us to do, though, is to have solid information so we can base our choices on reliable, accurate things. And then we can make choices that are consistent with our health and our well-being and frankly, with the compassion that is in our hearts, our decency. You know, I look at food as a mirror. So if you look at your food, your eating, what you eat, how you eat, where you eat, all of it, as a mirror, what do you see when you look in that mirror? Do you see self-respect? Do you see self-care? Do you see health? Do you see choices made on behalf of your greater well-being that take into account the well-being of the community, of the environment, of the farm workers, of everybody involved in the food system? Or do you see cheap choices that are convenient and tasty but are undermining who you really are, your ability to be healthy, your cells to vibrate with passion and power and caring for what you love? To me, the ability to make food choices so that when you look in the mirror, you see something you appreciate, you're grateful for, and that fuels your life, that's the goal. And for all, I think a lot of us want that. Not all of us are achieving that. It's more of an intention than it is a reality for a lot of us. But let's honor that intention and see if we can find ways to actualize it as much as possible.
I mean, it seems what also fuels this book. I mean, I know these are largely the columns you've written for Huffington Post that you've tweaked a lot to kind of for this book. But it feels like it's in the introduction to the book where you talk about Mrs. Obama's garden and the attacks she received for growing this organic garden, Michelle Obama, and you go on to describe how ludicrous that was given the power of big ag, of vertical industrial agriculture, has in our federal government, whether it's Barack Obama's administration or anybody else's.
It's true. When First Lady Michelle Obama planted an organic vegetable garden on the White House lawn, it seemed an innocuous thing to do. I didn't think that would be controversial, but it was. And CropLife America, which is the trade association that represents Monsanto and the other agrochemical companies that manufactures the pesticides, the genetically engineered foods, and so forth, they were just really upset about it, and they demanded that she use pesticides, which they call crop protection technology. And they said that by not using them, she was unfairly maligning chemical agriculture. It reminds me of when the bovine growth hormone, the genetically engineered growth hormone, was used very widely. It was first beginning to be used very widely in American dairies. And certain dairies, small dairies usually, would put on their packages, "We don't use bovine growth hormone. GMO-free, not genetically engineered, not mm-hmm. genetically modified, to accurately tell their customers that their dairy products, their milk, their cheese, their ice cream wasn't contaminated by this GMO product. And Monsanto, the manufacturer then of the GMO hormone, sued these dairies for unfairly maligning their product. They said that they were implying to the public that there was something better about a dairy product that hadn't been created with their product, with their genetically engineered hormone. And they actually won in court, not because they had wisdom or the light of humanity on their side, but because they had tremendous clout. Their lawyers were very well paid and had the financial power to crush these small dairies in court. What these things have in common here, Crop Life America complaining and getting major compensation from the Obama administration as a result, or Monsanto suing these farmers. What it has in common is industrial agriculture controlling our food system. They control the farm bill. They control what's taught in our schools about nutrition. They control what's taught to our doctors to be in medical education about nutrition. They have a phenomenal degree of influence over what we think and what we eat. And of course, the money that entails is just tremendous. It's in the trillions of dollars, and it's all funneled in a system that is not friendly to the body, to the human body. It's not producing food that's nutritious for us. And it's not friendly to the earth. It's not sustainable. It's not. It's full of pollution, frankly, and it contaminates the earth, the water, the soil, the atmosphere, the emissions of greenhouse gases. It's frankly a disaster, an ecological disaster.
There's a battle line being drawn. I mean, you talk about that in this book, and that's part of what you're talking about here, a line between what kind of future we want. I mean, we just saw that Mayor Bloomberg wants to ban large sugary drinks in the large containers in New York City. Things like that are happening across the country from the more establishment political level, but things are happening on all kinds of levels. And I think
there is a battle. And yes, Mayor Bloomberg did attempt. He's been called the Pharaoh of New York because he is so powerful there, and yet he didn't succeed in this. There have been 25 states in the last 2 years that have considered legislation that would put a tax on sugary drinks, the soda tax, it's sometimes called. And, of course, PepsiCo and Coca-Cola and the Beverage Association just fight this tooth and nail. And the result is that 25 states have considered the legislation, and it is defeated in every single one of them. The winners are the ones with the fat wallets, and the result is that we're becoming a fatter people. There really is a war. You know, on the one side, you have McDonald's and Monsanto and PepsiCo and Coca-Cola and really big ag. It's the industrial model. It's agrochemical based. It's genetically engineered based. It's rapacious and it's predatory to the earth. And on the other side, you have a growing group of concerned and passionate individuals and organizations fighting that we should have a healthy food supply, that it should be sane. I say sane, it should be sustainable. It should make sense. It should pay farmers enough that they can live a decent living wage. It shouldn't pollute. It shouldn't destroy the soil through soil erosion. It shouldn't destroy human health. It shouldn't destroy the planet. We want healthy people from eating healthy food, grown on healthy soil. And these two forces are on a collision course. And in every single instance, be it Bloomberg's efforts in New York to get the tax on high sugar drinks, or on efforts to label genetically engineered foods, or on efforts to structure the farm bill so that it subsidizes and incentivizes healthy food production rather than unhealthy food production, which it currently does. These battles keep being fought, and I am both a journalist reporting on this battle and, frankly, also an activist who's taken a side. As for me, I have made a choice.
And you know, you made a personal choice. I mean, you've decided to live your life as not quite a vegan, but as an almost vegetarian, an almost vegan.
Yeah, well, I've made a lot of personal choices, but I mean, I'm also making a choice as a voice, as an activist, as on the side of family farmers, on the side of a healthy food system, or on the side of organic and low input sustainable agriculture, on the side of small farms, locally grown food. All these ways that we can have more nutritious food that's less environmentally destructive and frankly builds community, keeps our money in our local areas, we don't need more Walmarts running our food system. Right now, what percentage do you think of all the groceries sold in the United States are actually sold by Walmart?
I should know this. Let's say 50%.
That's pretty close. It's approaching that number. It's about 30%, but it's growing rapidly. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but many people know that number. But it's growing rapidly. And what's happening with that, the Walmartization, I call it, or the McDonaldization of our food supply, which is well underway, and it's spreading internationally. We're KFC has got more makes more money in China now than they do in the United States. Baskin Robbins, which I know very well, has more stores in Tokyo than it does in Los Angeles. We are spreading this Western model of food production, factory farming, industrial ag, and the result is we're destroying cultures, we're destroying traditional cuisines, we're destroying traditional wisdom, we're really harming people, because as this model takes over in places, we predictably see, rising rates of obesity, rising rates of cancer, rising rates of heart disease, rising rates of diabetes. We see the undermining of the health of people. We see people alienated from what gives life. We see people broken by illness at increasingly younger ages. There's something happening in all of this that is deeply, deeply destructive, and it's insidious. And what I am grateful for is the rising people, the rising numbers of people, the ever-increasing numbers of people who are ever-increasingly passionate about breaking the hold that this industrial ag has over our thinking, over our choices, over our actions, over our policies, over our food.
So the question is, before we get into the heart of some of the essays in your book, which I really want to flesh out for our listeners, is your sense of how this is a book in some ways about warning, outrage, and what you might think about doing with your own lives and what can be done collectively to address the issues that you're raising here. But I'm curious what you think that what form that takes. I mean, I know that you described just now, a minute ago, the power of the Monsantos, the McDonald's of the world, and how they're moving into cultures throughout the planet, controlling seeds, controlling what people eat in urban areas, especially with fast foods, no matter what country it is. And then you had recently, I think just last month, or 2 months ago, the Food Revolution Virtual Summit, where you gathered people together to talk, people such as yourself who are in the front lines of the battle for a better world. So I'm curious how you see this playing out, given the power that you described a moment ago.
Well, yes, we did convene the first ever Food Revolution Summit, and we had 35,000 registrants.
Wow.
And I interviewed 24 experts, luminaries in the food world, from different philosophical orientations. And one of the things that emerged, one of the things that's happening today that I think our listeners want to know about is, because I think it's a point where the rubber meets the road. It's a point of actual leverage right now. And that is that there are in many states campaigns to get labeling of genetically engineered food. Now, both Vermont and Connecticut have recently come very close to passing bills that would mandate such labeling. In both cases, Monsanto threatened to sue the state. And in one case, it was the governor. In the other case, it was another, it was the legislature that backed down in deference, in fear, really, of the costs of not wanting to burden the taxpayers of the state with the cost of fighting Monsanto in court. However, this is bullying and intimidation from Monsanto, and it doesn't reflect the public interest. Most polls show 90% of the public want labeling of GMO food. It's very hard, honestly, to get that high a percentage of Americans to agree about anything today. It's very clear that this is an idea whose time has come. In California right now, over a million signatures have been gathered by organizations I'm involved with and support to get on the ballot this fall. It will be there, a ballot initiative. This is a way of bypassing the legislature, bypassing the governor, and getting the legislation passed, the ballot initiative. And it would mandate that genetically engineered foods sold in the state of California be labeled as such. It's not telling people you shouldn't buy them. It's not stigmatizing them. It's simply saying this is food that has been produced in this manner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we put on the label that there's so much salt, so much sodium in a given product, we're not stigmatizing salt. We're telling people that's how much is in there. It's a fact. It's not a judgment. Now, people can have their own judgments about it. Someone who's got high blood pressure might want to watch their sodium intake and therefore be aware, and they can read on that label and get the information they need so they can make healthier choices. People may have judgments that they want to make. I certainly do, about genetically engineered foods. I consider them dangerous. I've seen the studies, and I've seen the research, I've seen the science, and frankly, it's an experiment I don't want to put my body as part of being a guinea pig in. Every single lab animal that where there have been studies shows major problems, allergies, damage to the liver and kidneys, damage to the entire digestive tract. There's real problems.
Mm-hmm.
But there haven't been many studies on people. The ones that there have been show problems, but there haven't been very many, and that's because the U.S. government has just given a green light to the technology and not required testing. Well, there should have been testing. There should be testing. The public should at least know which foods contain these ingredients so they can make those informed choices.
If
you are in California or know somebody in California, let's see if we can pass this ballot initiative in this fall.
Yeah, I mean, and California plays a huge role in your book. I was going to ask something else, but let's talk about that for a second. I mean, that literally the title itself, No Happy Cows.
Well, the title, No Happy Cows, is the title of my book, and that comes from the California Milk Producers Association, which is the state dairy lobby. Has a national, actually international, ad campaign called Happy Cows, in which they say that great cheese comes from happy cows, and happy cows come from California. And they're trying to sell California cheese throughout the country. They've got cute cartoons involved. It's a $100 million ad campaign. And I think it's criminal, and here's why. California dairies are mostly concentrated in the Central Valley. It's very dry there. These are dairy feedlots that have up to 20 or 25,000 cows in them per. Most of these cows never see a blade of grass in their entire lives. They are anything but the happy cows implied by these ads. It's not like Wisconsin, which is a rainy area and used to be America's dairy state. I think the license plates of the state still say it is. But California produces significantly more dairy products now than does Wisconsin. California is by far the leading producer of dairy products in the country. But again, all in the dry Central Valley, or almost all of it. And so this to say that happy cows come from California, when in fact California cows are treated worse than the industry norm nationally. To me, it's not just false advertising, which it is, but it's more than that. There are many people who are willing to pay extra for organically grown food because they don't want the residues from those pesticides in their food, because they care about the farm workers and don't want those people exposed to these poisons, because they care about the earth and don't want to see our soil contaminated with these poisons and residues from them. And these are people who actually are more caring and thoughtful about their food choices in general than others. They're willing to put their money where their mouth is. They're willing to spend extra for it. If someone were to sell a product at a higher price and sell it as organically grown when it was not, that would be cheating. That would be actually criminal. That would be defrauding those consumers who are willing, who have a value, and are willing to pay extra for organic food. Similarly, we have now a large group of people and a growing group of people who are concerned about the treatment of animals in factory farms and feedlots, who see that as a violation of the human-animal bond, who don't want misery on their menu, and who are willing to pay extra for humanely raised animal products, meat, dairy products, and eggs. When the California Milk Producers Association presents the Happy Cow ad, and it states that, and not only states, but trumpets that great cheese comes from happy cows, and happy cows come from California, and it's not true. It's not even remotely true that happy cows come from California. They are defrauding those consumers who care about animals, who care about the treatment of animals. They're exploiting it. They're mocking it. It should be criminal. It's not just false advertising. It's criminal. And I have joined in a lawsuit against the California Milk Producers Association to get them to stop this fraudulent ad campaign. The reason I titled my new book, No Happy Cows, because, in fact, there are no happy cows in industrialized food production. There are no happy cows in California's Central Valley feedlot dairies. These are creatures whose lives are frustrations. All of their natural urges are frustrated. A dairy cow, under natural conditions, lives about 20 years, sometimes 25. Dairy cows in California's dairies today rarely see their fifth birthday.
And when you look at what you wrote in your book, I mean, it affects everything. When you just take the milk for a minute, you talk about in the book. You talk about what happens to these the no happy cows. You join the lawsuit, as you write about in the book, against to stop this campaign in California, out of California. But then you go on to talk about ice cream and other milk and the early onset of pubescence because of what's inside the what we feed our cows, what's in our milk. I mean, these are the things that I think people have to understand. That's because these four or five different of the essays really connect the dots, I think, if you put them together, of the relationship between industrial milk and what's happening to us now as people.
Well, it's true. And industrial milk is a long, you know, people have images in their mind of Bessie on the farm. And that's yesteryear. today's dairy production, as magnified in California, is feedlot dairy, and many of these large dairies still use Monsanto's genetically engineered bovine growth hormone to create more milk from the animal. They inject the cows with this hormone. It's an artificial hormone. One of the things that it does is it creates very large udders, and these poor creatures have very high rates when they're injected with this hormone of mastitis. So much so, which is an inflammation of the udder, so much so that when Monsanto delivers the hormone, or now Elanco, which is the division that has purchased that division from Monsanto, delivers the hormone, along with it, in the same shipment, comes the antibiotics that will be needed to treat the mastitis that is caused by the hormone. These creatures are sick. We're putting them through a level of stress that is cruel, and it's one of the reasons that they die at the ages of 4 or 5 years old instead of their natural lifespan of 20 to 25 years. The conditions we're subjecting them to are horrible. You know, it's pretty well known that veal calves are treated terribly. The Humane Society has for many years, and other animal groups have for many years, had a no veal this meal campaign to highlight that veal calves are subjected to conditions that no one would want if they saw it. In fact, I once took Julia Child, who was no vegetarian, I'll tell you, to a veal barn where she could see for herself how currently or at that time veal calves are treated. And Julia Child took one look at it, and just her whole face, her whole body language showed repulsion. What was a barn in which there were numerous stalls, individual stalls. The little calves were chained at the neck, one in a stall. The stalls were so small that the calves could not take a single step in any direction. They were chained at the neck by a chain so short that not only could they not take a single step in any direction, they also could not lay down in their normal sleeping position. So in order to sleep, they had to kind of hunch. They were standing knee-deep in their own excrement. Mm. It was horrible. And even Julia Child thought so. And she told me afterwards, she said, I had no idea it was this severe. And I wish that had been in the movie, you know, the Meryl Streep movie.
Yes, her. Yes.
Because it's not too many people realize it at the very end of her life, when, as a result, actually, of my discussions with her and taking her to this veal barn where she could experience for herself what it was. She signed off on veal, pushed it away, and wouldn't cook it anymore or recommend it. This isn't widely known, but still it is widely known, I think, that for many people that veal is really the poster boy for cruelty. The thing is that veal calves are all male calves born to dairy calves. Because dairy cows have to be impregnated annually in order to keep them lactating sufficiently for the production that's needed. And half the calves are female, and they then become four-legged milk pumps like their mothers. But the males have no use in the dairy industry. And because they're a breed that has been bred for milk production, they're really not worth fattening up for beef either. So they are shunted off into veal production, and they live a few months, and then they're killed. These are baby animals, baby calves, taken from their mothers at birth, chained under these conditions, the most deplorable conditions. You don't have to be a vegetarian. You certainly don't have to be an animal rights activist to find the level of cruelty involved in veal production, and frankly, in all of modern meat production. Abominable. If you actually see it, if the veil is lifted, and the industry with these stupid campaigns of happy cows come from California, all this greenwashing, all this humane washing, all this pretense, all this deceit, they're trying to keep the veil locked down so no one can actually see what's happening. They've got bills and legislatures called ag gag bills that prohibit journalists from exposing, from photographing what's actually taking place in these systems that are producing our meats, dairy products, and eggs, because they know that if people see it, they'll be repulsed, just like Julia Child was. And I'm trying, and a lot of people are trying, to fight that suppression of information and allow people to know what's going on so people can make informed choices about what we want to support with our policies and our personal
John Robbins, his latest book, No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution. We're going to take a very brief break and come right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. 1-800-878-8040. 638-7781.
I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
John Robbins has written books that have taken hold in our country, in our world, kind of challenging the way we think about our lives, when we eat, diet for a new America, of course, and the food revolution. He has a new book, and this is called No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Frontiers of the Food Revolution. Now, one of the things, there are a couple of places I like to go to with the conversation in terms of what you just said, and let me just stay with milk for a minute. I do want to get to the obesity issue here with you before we have to leave, and some of the other things that you've written about in these essays, and introduced to some of the people. I thought the piece on the pig farmer was just very moving and stunning. But to stay with milk just for a second, I mean, because if you tie in the things you wrote in these different essays, to me, whether it was the soy wars of Fallon and Enig and others who were writing about how terrible soy is, and what soy versus milk in some ways, and soy milk versus milk, but also the when you write about what's happening to people who drink the milk, what's happening to our children, why there's this early onset of pubescence, and this what's happening to us as a result of this is something that I think America needs to know. I mean, we need to talk about this, and we will call the industry if they'll respond. They probably won't, but I mean, this is a key to really kind of driving home what this milk that's filled with all these hormones and antibiotics are doing to our children.
Yes, we've seen a lot of studies that have quite fully established that the onset of menstruation in young girls, their first period, is happening at earlier and earlier ages. In traditional cultures, girls would begin to menstruate usually around the age of 16 or 17. In our culture today, it's been decreasing gradually and steadily for a number of years, and is now around 11 and a half. And in some areas, even 9 and a half. And this has been traced, and in some very, very unfortunate situation where the Monsanto's genetically engineered hormones have been used at levels that were illegal and should never have been used. We've had the tragedy of girls starting to menstruate, believe it or not, at the age of 3 or 4. This is a medical emergency. It should never happen. But it is an exaggeration of a trend that is taking place ubiquitously in our society, so, and gradually, such that no one's outraged about it, but we should. There are real medical implications to this. The earlier a girl begins to menstruate, the higher her risk lifetime of breast cancer and uterine cancer and ovarian cancer. But also, it means that she's younger when she becomes of reproductive age. It means that her psyche, she's still a little girl, and her psyche isn't developed yet, or ready yet, for these surges of hormones and the feelings and thoughts and identity crises that inevitably ensue. We're forcing our kids to grow up way too soon in this way, and we're forcing them chemically to do it. Today's high-fat foods play a role in this, but particularly the types of fats that are in dairies, and particularly when those dairy products have been produced from cows that have been injected with Monsanto's hormone.
You've mentioned Monsanto a lot during this interview, and I because let's just take 2 seconds, if you wouldn't mind, to talk about the sheer power of some of these companies. As we were talking, one of my producers showed me an article that was in the Prairie Advocate News. Took place on May 22nd of this year, where Illinois seized bees the scientists was working on for 15 years that were resistant to Monsanto's Roundup. They destroyed the queens, killed his research, part of it saying that Monsanto should be able to look at what's going on here. The power we're talking about to stop people from being independent with its seeds, bees, I mean, it's frightening.
Is frightening, and what's happening with bees is frightening. We have a phenomena that's called colony collapse disorder, which is an odd name. What's really taking place is that our bees are dying off in tremendous numbers. The bee industry, the beekeeping industry, is having a terrible time with this, trying to track down what's happening. There are a number of indications that Monsanto's genetically engineered corn in particular, also some other seed additives that they create, that they produce and market, are involved. There's one group, and this may be what the article you're referring to is about, that's been trying for many years to try to understand what is causing colony collapse disorder, because bees are our primary pollinators, and if they die, our whole entire food supply is jeopardized. This is serious stuff. This is not just some nice environmentalist thing. This deals with our ability to feed ourselves. And there was this one group of bee specialists that were dedicated to finding out what the problem was. Monsanto bought the organization and then suppressed all of the information that that organization had developed. Mm. This is criminal. This is thugs. This is the level of a conspiracy, because they are conspiring against the interests of all of us for their profit. It should not be allowed. There's no reason whatsoever that we should have policies that permit this kind of activity. If we continue to allow it, what will happen is that our food supply will not only be increasingly polluted, but it will be increasingly unavailable to people. We're going to see not the world's hungry fed, as Monsanto claims it's attempting to do. That's just PR. They want to control the food supply. They want to dominate the whole world food system. They want to control seeds. They want to own water. They want to control every part of the process. We have to stop them. We really do. And I do mention Monsanto a great deal because they are the primary player in genetic engineering of food and in agrochemical agriculture.
I think that it really is important for people to understand this, the power that exists in all this. And one of the things that you also talk about, and I think that is important. I mean, the way you tell the stories in No Happy Cows, I think is important. I mean, I think that because you humanize the issue. You begin in the beginning of your book talking about this pig farmer, industrial pig farmer who you went to visit. That was just, I've met a lot of farmers who are wrestling with their lives, and so, and so that really hit me to see this. The story you painted, because oftentimes I think activists and people in the environmental movement and people around blame the farmer. They go after the farmer as the problem, which is a real mistake.
It is a mistake, and it's not fair. And often the people who take that easy route, that cheap route of blaming like that, don't understand. I've grown food. My wife and I grew 95% of the food we ate for about 10 years, and we still grow a good amount. It's hard. It's hard work, particularly if you want to do it organically. Using chemicals is very attractive. It's alluring because it's quick and easy. Those people who want to grow organic food can do it, but it's a lot of work, and it takes time and energy, and it's not easy. And raising animals isn't easy. Food production is actually quite difficult, and very few people are involved in it today. You know, 100 years ago, half of the population was involved in food production, in farming, actually. Now it's way less than 1%. We've industrialized, and that's taken us, given us the freedom to do other things. What we need to do is find ways to grow that it is sustainable, is healthy, is humane, and yet still frees up a lot of us to do other things, because most of us don't want to farm. But some of us do, and those of us who do should be respected, should be supported, should be honored, not criticized. There are choices that are being made for the farmer economically by the Farm Bill, for example. by our food policy, by the USDA. The farmers then are pushed in a certain direction. We have tilted the playing field so severely in the direction of agrochemicals. It's very hard to, for example, if you want to grow organic food today, you have to get, if you want to sell it as organic and have it certified so that the public will know that it is indeed organic, you have to pay for that certification process. It's expensive. I know a number of organic farmers who don't sell their food as organic, even though they are organic, and have to take a lower price than they could if they labeled it as organic, but they don't because they can't afford the certification. Well, that makes it more expensive for organic growers than it is for conventional growers who don't pay for such certification. We have all kinds of ways that we tilt the playing field, making it cheaper for unhealthier food. I mean, why is it, actually, that Twinkies are cheaper than carrots?
That's true. Right, right.
Yeah?
Right.
Because of our food policy. And why is it easier in most cities to find a convenience store where you can buy a candy bar or a Coke or some junky sugar water product or a pack of cigarettes? That's more conveniently available than to buy a stalk of broccoli. We have set up a food system that pushes farmers and pushes consumers towards unhealthy food. It makes it cheaper to do the wrong thing. We need to reverse that and make it cheaper to do the right thing, better, easier to do the right thing.
Talk for a minute about, before we really run out of time here, there's several things I want to get to. We'll get to as many as we can, but one of them is your essay on vitamin water. I thought was very revealing and very important because, you know, when in the studio or out with young people or at the seeing people work out or everybody running a race, everybody's drinking this vitamin water that I've always been skeptical of, but never really looked at it until I saw that piece that you wrote.
Well, you have reason to be skeptical. And, of course, it's sold as a health food. It helps
right.
you drink. LeBron James and Kobe Bryant are in all the ads. And the ads say it's a healthy drink. And the name vitamin water certainly implies that it's full of nutrients. Actually, what it is sugar water with less than a penny's worth of synthetic vitamins sprayed into it and artificial flavor. It's only a little bit less sweet than Coca-Cola, and it is owned by Coca-Cola. Vitamin water is a
right.
subsidiary of Coca-Cola. And it's only barely, if at all, healthier than Coca-Cola, which is a very low bar to compare it to, obviously. But what's interesting is the Center for Science and the Public Interest actually initiated a lawsuit against Coca-Cola for the ad campaigns and in which they claim that vitamin water is a healthy drink. What's staggering, and what my article spoke about, and it became, by the way, one of the most read articles on the Internet in the United States last year.
Huh.
Phenomenal. It went viral in a phenomenal way. And I was talking about the court case, and in court, Coca-Cola's attorneys
right.
argued that it wasn't false advertising because no reasonable person could possibly assume that vitamin water was a healthy beverage. No reason. It's unreasonable then to believe that a product named vitamin water is made out of vitamins and water? It's unreasonable to believe their ads? That's what they were saying. And it's an amazingly creative legal ploy. And they've got some very expensive lawyers pushing it in court. But it reflects a disrespect to the American consumer that is egregious.
And when you think about, I mean, I was tying this chapter into your chapter on obesity and the story of the man who died and the story of your friend Natala who fought back for her life. And then you look at this chapter on Vita Water that you write about. You know, we know that 35% or more of Americans are obese. But that and this one stat that you had from the Hopkins Bloomberg School, which is right here in our city of Baltimore, 25% of our calories come from liquids,
yeah.
like Vita Water. And soda.
Yeah, if you want to lose weight, one of the first things to do is just drop drinking sugar water, because various kinds of sugar water, I mean, whether it's carbonated or not, whether it's got some herbs added to it or not, or some vitamins added to it or not, those things don't compensate. They don't make a healthy difference, because you're still drinking basically sugar water. And it might be sugar, it might be high fructose corn syrup, it might be any number of forms of sugar, but it's all empty calories. It's all going to add to your waistline and not give you the nutrients you need. You know, your cells need nutrients. We need food. Food is a precious thing. And I, frankly, am grateful for food. I think I'm grateful to the farmers who work so that we can eat. I'm grateful to the soil that grows the food and to the climate that allows it, to the rain that irrigates it, to the people who dig the wells and harvest the crops and drive the trucks that bring the food to our restaurants and markets. I'm very, very grateful to everyone involved in feeding us. We need food, and we need healthy food. Our cells need it, our systems need it, so that we can have a healthy body. But when you eat empty calories, which are calories that don't contain nutrients, your cells aren't fed what they need. So you need to eat more food to get those nutrients. And so you're hungrier for nutrients, even though you've already eaten a lot of calories, which makes, we have a lot of fat-starving people. They're starving for nutrients, not calories. We shouldn't eat any calories that aren't coupled with nutrients. We shouldn't eat empty calories, because it makes us fat. And it makes us empty inside. It makes us hungry. It makes us unsatisfied. It makes us angry and alienated people. And there is so much at stake here. If we can truly find a food system, create a food system and a way of eating, so that when we look in the mirror that food provides to us, we see ourselves acting in concert with the natural world to produce healthy bodies, healthy minds, healthy children, healthy communities, a healthy way of life, then we will have done something precious and powerful. And then we will have done something that our passions for life will have taken a constructive form. And I think this is a tremendously significant challenge today, given the power of Monsanto and so forth. But there are more and more people wanting to see this take place, wanting to be part of it, wanting to be engaged. I wrote No Happy Cows for those people.
I'm glad you did. I'm also glad you said it was okay to eat Cadbury's. John Robbins, his latest book, No Happy Cows, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Food Revolution. John Robbins, thank you so much for everything.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our associate producer is Cassandra Monsanto. Our producers are Justin Levy, Cricket Arison, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.